Okay, well, first of all, it's great to be here at this workshop. It's great to see all these people that are interested in these issues. I guess what I'm planning to do, I know this was supposed to be a kind of informal discussion. I made some slides. I'll try to get through them, I think, in about, hopefully half an hour. We'll see if that works. Just sort of going over some of the results that I've worked on in this area, based on a series of papers with these authors, and there's been some closely related papers by people here. So I'll give kind of a summary of the results, of an overview of where I think we are. And then hopefully the last half or so, I'll switch to the Blackboard and kind of put some open issues and future directions that are kind of interesting to explore, maybe worth exploring. So I made a slide of motivation. But in a way, I think the best motivation is that we're here and we're interested in these issues. We'd like to understand how local physics somehow emerges or arises from a boundary conformal field theory. So that's motivation enough, and I'll just kind of skip to an approach, which actually is something that's been worked on since the earliest days of ABS-CFT. What you can imagine doing is trying to express local observables, local field operators in the bulk of ABS, somehow in terms of CFT degrees of freedom. So as I said, this is a very old program. Gary Horowitz was one of the earliest papers on ABS-CFT. Kind of took steps in this direction. And the basic sort of thing that you're after, imagine we had a free field in ABS. So here's some generic free field in ABS. It depends on some boundary coordinates x. It also depends on a radial coordinate z. And the idea is to somehow express this field in terms of the dual operator in the conformal field theory. So that's an operator that just lives on the boundary. And the idea is that at the free field level, you can just write some kind of smearing kernel here and express your field in the bulk as an integral of the operator on the boundary smeared out over some region in the CFT. So that's the sort of construction you might expect for free fields. If you have interacting fields in ABS, or if you have a conformal field theory that's not in a strict large n limit, but has some 1 over n corrections, then you might expect a more general expression where you're still trying to represent a field in the bulk, but now it's an interacting field. And in order to make it in terms of CFT degrees of freedom, you can't get away with just a single operator in the CFT. There's probably a whole power of operators, single trace, double trace, multi-trace operators. So you need to sum over the tower of operators and then smear each operator appropriately, add it all up, and the hope is that that would represent some kind of local field in the bulk of ABS. So that's the basic construction that we're after. And there's a very simple example which illustrates how things can work out. And that's just a free massless scalar field in ABS2. So here's the ABS2 metric. There's a time coordinate t, which is a time in the conformal field theory. There's an additional radial coordinate z. And what you'd like to do in this background metric to describe a free massless scalar field, you want to solve the wave equation, box phi equals 0. And there are some boundary conditions that you want to satisfy. in particular, if you study how the scalar field behaves as you approach the boundary of ADS, as you send z to 0, the scalar field has to fall off. It has to go like z times some coefficient. You interpret that coefficient as a dimension one operator in the CFT. So you want to solve the wave equation with these boundary conditions. And that's easy to do. You can almost just guess the solution. Your field in the bulk, what you do, you take your operator on the boundary, and you integrate it over the boundary from t minus z to t plus z. Multiply by half, that's the solution. And it's kind of obvious. This clearly satisfies the wave equation. If you act with d plus d minus on this, you get 0. And also, it satisfies the boundary condition, because as you send z to 0, the interval that you're integrating over on the boundary just shrinks to a point. So you can bring the operator out in front of the integral. The integral then just gives you a 2z. You divide by 2, so that satisfies the boundary conditions. And so this is an example of carrying out the program for a free field. You can kind of draw a picture. This is supposed to be the Penrose diagram for ADS2, which ADS2 has two boundaries. The Penrose diagram is an infinite vertical strip. There's a point somewhere in the bulk of ADS2. You want to represent a field operator inserted there. What you do is just follow light rays to the boundary. That defines an interval on the boundary, that red interval. And that's the region that you need to smear the operator over. And this representation has some kind of nice features. The support of the kind of smearing kernel on the boundary is just at space-like separation from the bulk point. And one nice thing about the representation is that it kind of makes it clear that if you take the bulk point and move it to the boundary, the interval shrinks to a point, as I said. And it makes it kind of manifest that a field operator in the bulk actually goes over to a local operator in the CFT in the limit that the bulk point goes to the boundary.
Here you have just preferred one boundary over the other.
Yeah, that's right. Actually, here it was an arbitrary choice. I could have drawn my light rays the other direction and gone to the other boundary. But here it was just an arbitrary choice.
So what about the uniqueness of this? This is an example, or there? Is this unique in any way?
I'll take this as sort of a prototype example. And most of what I'm going to tell you about is an attempt to kind of push similar results through in other contexts.
And the weight of the operator is not important from the point of view of the width?
The dimension, you mean?
Yes.
So here I'm doing a massless field in ADS2, which is dual to a dimension one operator. So in fact, there will be a weight factor that we need to insert there when we consider operators of other dimension. We'll see that in a minute.
So if you added a homogeneous solution to the field equation, you modify the value of the field at the origin at the point you're looking at.
That's right. That's right.
Okay. So now you are seeing that encoded in this out or not?
So this whole field is a homogeneous solution. It satisfies the free wave equation.
Well, okay. So you're saying if I know the boundary conditions on the red segment.
Yeah, that's right. So I'm thinking of a one-dimensional CFT as living on this line. Mm-hmm. So I've got an operator that lives on this line. Mm-hmm. And what I'm doing, if you like, is taking that local operator in the CFT and lifting it to represent a local operator somewhere in the bulk. So it's a solution to the homogeneous weight equation in the bulk.
Yeah.
With the boundary condition that if I send z to 0, my bulk field goes back to the local operator.
Yeah, so you're saying that the boundary conditions on the red interval are sufficient to determine the solution, basically.
Yes, that's right. Yeah, you see that explicitly here.
Is that true? I mean, I probably don't want to spend too much time dwelling on this because ADS2 is always special, but you've really only got boundary conditions on one side. Is that enough to determine the solution of the bulk uniquely?
Well, let's see. It is actually. For reasons that I'm not sure if they're trivial or profound, but if you solve the wave equation for a massless field in ADS2, there's a symmetry under an antipodal map that exchanges the two boundaries. So I think actually,
it's not really too bad. I mean, the field matches the boundary and the derivative is equal to 0. So why is it surprising now we have a solution?
So, yeah, I think it's true. Knowing the operator in that red interval is enough to reconstruct the bulk field. So what I'd like to do is take this as sort of a prototype example and see if we can carry out a similar construction in a kind of more general context. An obvious generalization is to go away from ADS2, consider ADS D plus 1. And the construction actually generalizes quite easily. As long as you're willing to work on the complexified boundary, we'll need to consider complex values of the boundary spatial coordinates. Seems a little bit strange. In my perspective, it actually seems that complexifying the boundary spatial coordinates is necessary. I don't really think it's an option.
I don't know if you want to get. I mean, first, I disagree that it's necessary. Second, it's very confusing to complexify space. I mean, you know, correlators and operators have canonical with rotations in finite direction. They don't have canonical rotations in space-like direction. And so, when you start using these, you have to make prescriptions. Oh, they have to be solved. You can't use them. They have very restricted domains or something. You can't use them as freely as you normally use operators.
That's true. So what I'll actually need as a kind of the technical assumption is that if you give me correlation functions in the CFT, that I can analytically continue those to complex values of spatial coordinates. And as far as I can tell, there's no obstacle to doing that. I think this step of complexifying is actually necessary.
Are you going to discuss that? I mean, this is worth a discussion either now or after you finish your slide.
Yeah, so it seems necessary for kind of slightly technical reasons. So there's a slide at the end where we can go through.
So we can bring up the discussion. The question.
So maybe I'll kind of hold off on that until the end. We can say more about it then. I think it is an interesting issue. So I don't know, Veronica and Lucan had a paper yesterday or the day before where
complexify anything.
Well, exactly. So that's kind of what I'm wondering, whether how this idea that you need to complexify spatial coordinates fits in with your work. That'd be an interesting thing to understand.
You might be even more concerned in the interacting theory if this is what you have to do at the free level. So are you going to say things that address that?
My claim is that it works in the free theory and that it also works at least order by order in perturbation theory. Non-perturbatively, I'm not so sure. So I guess we maybe hold off on questions about the complex spatial coordinates and just kind of write down the result. So here it is in an arbitrary AES. This is the result for a massless scalar. And it's kind of the obvious generalization of what we had in AES 2. Here's an operator in the bulk. There's a time coordinate, some spatial coordinates on the boundary, and the radial coordinate z. This is the dual operator. And what you do is integrate that dual operator over a region on the complexified boundary. So t is the real kind of boundary time. Y is actually the imaginary value of the boundary spatial coordinate. There's a factor of I sitting there. And the region that you integrate over on the complexified boundary, it's actually just a ball of radius z. There is a way to think about this. You don't need to think about it this way, and this result is something you can derive strictly in ADS. You can check that this satisfies the wave equation and has the right boundary conditions. But a way to think about it is that imaginary spatial coordinates in ADS, sort of like rotating the spatial coordinates, it turns ADS into De Sitter space. And then this representation becomes the kind of natural representation for a bulk field in De Sitter space, where you have a point in the bulk, you follow the light cone to the past De Sitter boundary, and then you integrate over data on the past De Sitter boundary over a ball of radius z. So if you want to draw a picture to go along with this, that's a picture you can draw.
If you wrote your spacetime in different coordinates, just a simple coordinate transformation, then would that be prescription be invariant under it or not?
So you can make changes of coordinates and.
Your complexification would be completely different, right? Ways integrating always in different one time.
So you've complexified the manifold. There's a slice through the complexified manifold that's actually carries a De Sitter metric. But then you could choose whatever coordinates you wanted to describe that slice. So you could rewrite this in different coordinates if you wanted to.
Any choice of Lorentzian coordinates, if you leave that Lorentzian spatial coordinates for complex coordinate and then integrate the imaginary part of that, would be reducing
half-space. Yeah, any similarly available choice of all these coordinates.
Depending on how you choose your coordinates, it could look more complicated. But there is a kind of an invariant statement here.
And is it just for pure ADS, or it's
This is pure ADS. This is all pure ADS. The result I showed you was for a massless scalar. You might ask what happens for a massive scalar, one that's dual to some operator of arbitrary dimension delta in the CFT. Then it's basically the same formula. The only thing that changes is you insert this factor. And this factor is, I guess I'll call it the bulk to boundary distance, raised to the power delta minus d. So sigma is actually the kind of invariant geodesic distance in ADS. That distance diverges if you send one point to the boundary. But then you can multiply it by z prime, where z prime goes to zero. It's kind of a regulator. That gives you a finite quantity, which is well defined as z prime goes to zero. I'll call that the bulk to boundary distance. And you just have to insert that to an appropriate power. One nice thing about this representation is that it's actually, it's basically uniquely fixed by the symmetries. And the way that works, well, we've got an operator in the CFT of dimension delta. This bulk to boundary distance, sigma is invariant with Z transforms. So this thing has dimension D minus delta. And we're in a d-dimensional CFT, so the measure there carries mass dimension minus d. So you put all of these things together, you get a dimensionless quantity. So you get a scalar field in the bulk that transforms with weight zero under under conformal transformations. So if you like, the whole result is basically fixed by symmetries. Kind of only ambiguity is what exponent you should put there, but that's fixed by the dimension of your operator.
There's no solution to the problem without this complex integration?
I believe not, and I have a slide on that at the end, so we can come back to that.
What are the arguments of sigma then?
So sigma, you have a point in the bulk, coordinates t, x, z, and you have a point on the boundary with coordinates t plus t prime, x plus I, y prime. So sigma is the distance between those two points. So that's a general scalar field. Kind of our most recent paper, it was also a paper by Heemskerk. We studied gauge fields in ADS. So of course, the CFT is gauge invariant. Doesn't know about bulk gauge symmetries. So if you're going to try to reconstruct a gauge field in the bulk, you need to make some choice of gauge. The most natural choice of gauge is to set the radial component of the gauge field to zero. And once you do that, you get a very simple result. A gauge field in the bulk is dual to a current, J mu, in a CFT. What you need to do, you take that current, and you integrate it over a sphere of radius z on the complexified boundary. And doing that gives you actually z times A mu in the bulk. This result is basically fixed by symmetries. The current has dimension d minus 1. You're integrating over a sphere that has also has dimension d minus 1. Everything on the right is actually conformally invariant. Z times AU also carries weight 0 in the bulk. So this result is basically fixed by the symmetries. There's kind of particularly simple example, which is to look at ADS3. So in ADS3, we have some current in the CFT. So the current is chiral, say it's J minus. It only depends on the x minus light cone coordinate in the CFT. A chiral current like that is actually dual to a Chern-Simons gauge field in the bulk. The kind of amusing thing is, since this current is, well, I guess we'd call it holomorphic, if you plug that such a current into this integral, you can just do the integral once and for all. And what you find is that the current is dual to a bulk field. The bulk field is just that the A plus and AZ components of the gauge field vanish. The A minus component in the bulk is just equal to whatever the current is on the boundary. So I think this is actually the world's simplest example of holography. You take a current algebra in a two-dimensional CFT. You just declare that your current doesn't depend on x plus or z, and you call it a gauge field in the bulk. You can check that the Chern-Simons equations of motion are satisfied. If you regard this as a connection, A minus only depending on X minus, that's a flat connection in the bulk, so.
This is topological field theory, probably.
True science.
Right, but it's sort of, it's even more poverty-stricken than holography.
The fact that it's topological is what makes it such a simple realization of holography. That's certainly true.
Is the highest end theory topological in the same sense?
Maybe it's three, yes.
Maybe it's three.
You mean some of them?
There's both scalars, there's all these points.
So there's not that some similarly simple relation.
I don't think so, because there's a bunch of other stuff besides the sure science stuff. There's both scalars, there's light states, whatever they are.
There are purely topological higher spin theories, but those aren't the ones that are conjectured to be dual to the WI minimal models.
Okay, good, but the ones that are, say, the previous four, the ones that are dual to the Sillian theories?
Those have scalars.
Those are in three plus one boxes, not a natural.
All they have no local book in it. You can gauge everything away to the boundary. You can gauge everything to the boundary.
So I think they're not. No. In those cases, as Wei reported to us last week, in those cases you can linearize around ADS and fix all the gauges and you find propagating particles of all integer spins.
Yes. You find propagating particles.
Yes.
And that's not just a gauge argument. I recall you saying in geometry and data that you go to a gauge and the fields are constant in the ball. But the answer is no to my question.
On a two series of the formal partition function, there's a lot of stuff in the
So that's how gauge fields work in the bulk. Maybe not surprisingly, gravity is kind of similar. Again, you have to make a gauge choice. These are Pfefferling Graham coordinates. Set HZZ and HZU to zero. So the only component of the metric perturbation you need to worry about is one where both indices are tangent to the boundary. And the way you make it, you take the stress tensor and the CFT, you basically just average it over a ball of radius z on the complexified boundary, and that gives you z squared times h mu nu in the bulk. Again, things are simple if you go to ADS3, Then the different components of the stress tensor are either holomorphic or anti-holomorphic. You find that the metric perturbation in the bulk is just exactly equal to the stress tensor on the boundary. So H minus minus is equal to T minus minus. H plus plus is T plus plus. The plus minus component vanishes. So it's kind of amusing. It means there's a Virasoro algebra in the bulk. The stress tensor on the boundary obeys a Virasoro algebra. The metric perturbation in the bulk is just exactly equal to the stress tensor on the boundary.
This is using Einstein's equations?
This does give you, we're constructing on-shell fields in the bulk, so yes, they satisfy Einstein's equation.
Right, so H mu nu is T mu nu plus something that vanishes on shell.
That's right. There's only so much one can do with free fields. A natural question is, can you include interactions? And by interactions here, I'm going to mean, I have in mind a large N CFT, and I'm going to try to take into account interactions using a 1 over N expansion of the CFT. And we have some results on this for scalar fields in the bulk. And for scalar fields, there are kind of two different approaches that one can follow. One approach, and one way of thinking about it, is that you imagine taking some bulk equations of motion. Imagine you knew what the bulk equations of motion were. And then you just try to solve them perturbatively. So for example, suppose we had a phi cubed theory in the bulk. Our bulk equation of motion would be something like Laplacian of phi is some coupling constant times phi squared. You can try to write the solution to that equation as an expansion in powers of lambda. The lowest order term will be independent of lambda. First order correction will be order lambda to the first, lambda squared, and so on. Then the kind of nonlinear equation of motion in the bulk turns into a whole power of equations. At lowest order, you just have to solve Laplacian of phi naught equals zero. That's the free equation. That's the one we already know how to solve. So we could represent phi naught as one of those smearing kernels that I talked about, integrated against some operator on the boundary. And then if you look at the first order correction, you need to solve Laplacian of phi 1 is equal to the coupling constant times phi naught squared. We know how to solve such equations. Phi naught, the thing that appears on the right-hand side, we already know how to represent in terms of the CFT. So you can solve this using a Green's function. Phi 1 is some Green's function, 1 over Laplacian, acting on something you know how to construct in the CFT. So this is an approach to taking interactions into account perturbatively, and this is an approach that's been kind of particularly emphasized by some of the people here. So that certainly works. I guess the thing which, at least to me, is not so appealing about this approach is that it seems to rely on knowing what the bulk equations of motion are. And if you actually have the bulk equations of motion, you're going to do bulk perturbation theory anyways, then it seems there one isn't somehow kind of fully making use of ADS-CFT. So there's a second approach that one can take, which is to take the sort of guiding principle to be bulk microcausality. And I don't know, maybe this resonates with some of the things that Fanny was telling us this morning. So the idea here is, let's start with the CFT. Imagine we know all of the operators, all of the correlation functions in the CFT. So we know the full operator algebra there. That operator algebra will regard as sort of the boundary limit of an operator algebra in the bulk. So what we want to do is take that boundary operator algebra and kind of lift it or promote it to get local fields in the bulk of ADS. And the principle which kind of lets you do that, at least for scalar fields, seems to be imposing causality in the bulk. So here's a sketch of how that goes. Let's imagine we had some two-point function in the CFT, so some correlator O1, O2. What we could do, we could take, say, that first operator, apply one of these smearing kernels to it. And that would give us a two-point correlator where the first operator is now sitting somewhere in the bulk. The second operator we've left on the boundary. And if you think about it a bit, this bulk to boundary two-point function is actually guaranteed to respect causality. This bulk operator and this boundary operator will actually commute inside the correlator whenever the bulk and boundary points are space-like separated. And the reason that's kind of built into the construction, the way we got this smearing kernel was by solving a free wave equation. Free wave equations, you solve the free wave equation, that kind of guarantees you're going to get the two-point function correctly. There's no surprise that this exactly reproduces the block.
You have some kind of complexification of that one. So you're relying on, this O1 is a complexified quotient.
It's true. The O1 inside there is at complex coordinates. But after I smear it, I think of this whole collection as just sitting at some point inside real ADS. So the condition I want to impose is that when the bulk point in real ADS is space-like separated from the other boundary point, that it's being smeared.
Well, what is the microcausality input? That O1 went to commute or space-like separations?
So O1 and O2, those are CFT operators. They have the standard CFT two-point function. You can take the standard CFT correlator and analytically continue it to complex values of the spatial coordinates. For O1 and O2, just thinking of them as living in the CFT.
Normally, there's a notion of space-time separation. What is complexified space-time separation?
What you can do, you can take the standard CFT two-point function. So 1 over x minus y to the delta to delta. You can analytically continue that to complex values of the spatial coordinates.
Now I have 1 over x plus i y minus x prime.
You can ask whether that's symmetric under exchange of the arguments or not. They'll commute with each other, even at complex spatial coordinates, until you hit some kind of singularity in the correlator.
There is no singularity in the
real. You don't have branch points and stuff like that.
You do see that. Whenever x plus y is null. I mean, you're seeing this all over the place.
You should be analytically continuing, if you believe old-fashioned books that I read as a child, to the future tube. Now, the future tube is not where you make the spatial coordinates. You use the analyticity in real Minkowski space, positive energy in real Minkowski, to continue to the future tube.
We understand, but this is not
that. It's very strict.
That's
because they won't be necessarily holomorphic in that direction, right?
What's the sort of thing we have in mind? You've got some CFT correlator, O1 of F, T and X, O2 of, say, 0 and 0. This is 1 over minus t squared plus x squared to the appropriate number, dimension of the operator. That's an expression which certainly has singularities on the length cone. I could start with this expression, say, when the operators are at large space-like separation, and then there's no obstacle to continuing this to complex values of x.
It might depend if delta isn't an integral, so it could depend on which direction you did your continuation.
I don't know if this will help. So this prescription that we use for calculating correlators of all of these operators, we always begin when things are well space-like separated. So you start at large space-like separation, and then analytically continue from there.
And you only go to the light cone, right? Your support is all on one side of the light cone.
So in the complex X space, the statement is you're the ball that you're looking at is up until you hit branch points in the complex X plane.
That's right. So you work. So the way we calculate actually a core. Suppose we wanted to do a bulk to bulk 2-point function. So here's time in the CFT. Here's a spatial coordinate in the CFT. So what we do, we'd start when our two operators are well space-like separated. So there's one operator that gets smeared in the CFT, maybe over some interval in time. And it's also smeared over it's actually a kind of a disk. So it also goes in the imaginary spatial direction, which I guess I can't really draw, but you can sort of think of it as sticking out of the board. And there might be some other operator kind of way over here that's also smeared out in time and the imaginary spatial direction. But these two things are well space-like separated from each other. So all of the correlators are kind of unambiguous. You can calculate everything there. And then you can analytically continue. As you analytically continue, you do eventually hit singularities, because eventually some point in the support of one smearing function will be light-like separated from some place in the support of the other. So at that point, you hit a singularity. You need to know how to continue past that singularity. And the way that we do that, so you do need an I epsilon prescription at that point. And the question is whether this correlator that you're calculating, whether you want it to be a Whiteman correlator or a Feynman correlator, that will give you different I epsilon prescriptions and give you different ways of analytically continuing to when, say, the bulk and boundary point are time-like to each other. This seems like an unambiguous prescription for calculating these correlators. Or at least that's the prescription that we use.
Instead of manifestly coordinate dependent, this is
it. Let's see.
So you write the flat space, more than two dimensions, if you write a flat space in spherical coordinates or something, then you're continuation of your radial coordinate
will be different from the continuation of the angular ones will be manifestly different from the single part. That's true. You can work out the particular kind of representation that I've given you here, this has been working in Poincaré coordinates. And I think you could do the same construction using whatever coordinates, you like. You do. And so I think you're free to do this construction. Well, this is the Poincaré construction. But you can change coordinates, look in different coordinate systems, and I think in the end you get exactly the same expressions.
Even in terms of this what you call this microcausality, not just the full integral, but this effectively null
circuit. That's right, because that's the idea of things being null separated, that's independent of coordinates.
Yeah, space time, that is, but not if you start thinking these extra directions based on some model of coordinates. That's what's confusing. So clearly in Lorentzian space time, you have a very well defined notion of null separated, but now the amount of distance you go in the sort of complexified spatial direction seems to depend on what you call what coordinate you use for that spatial direction.
It sort of does. There is this picture which actually is kind of more invariant. For working with these complex spatial coordinates, it does take you to the Sitter metric. And then this actually is an invariant thing, because you're taking a point somewhere in the bulk, you take the past light cone, it cuts the boundary somewhere. So this picture is actually coordinate independent.
I kind of buy that, but I'm just confused about a very, very basic thing about the signature here. So how do you get by complexifying your spatial coordinates to a Lorentzian Disinter space?
The signature flips.
So the Z direction is familiar to your time. Sorry, stupid question.
It actually is an inherent notion, and you could rewrite this picture in whatever coordinates.
You started out with the ingoing coordinates, like light-like coordinates, with some bit of t plus, let's say, t plus x instead of t. So that still would have, then you would have promoted that full coordinate into your sort of time coordinate and left only the remaining three for that. That's it. Boundary like some coordinates. So just some x plus epsilon t already would seem to be giving you some degree.
The slice that corresponds to real De Sitter. If you choose arbitrary coordinates, that slice could be kind of complicated to describe. So the fact that in Poincaré coordinates we could just smear in the imaginary spatial directions, if I made some arbitrary change in coordinates, I'm not sure that would be true. There would still be some hypersurface that I'd smear over, but it wouldn't be such a simple one to state. Take us back to the causality stuff. As I tried to argue that if you look at two-point functions, they come out to respect causality by construction. But if you started with a three-point correlator in the CFT, applied one of these smearing kernels to the first operator, there's absolutely no reason to expect that this will respect bulk causality. So you do the calculation. Indeed, you find that bulk causality is violated. This thing has singularities not only when the bulk and boundary points are light-like set, but also it has singularities where you might have expected them, where the support of the smearing function on the boundary is light-like separated from one of the other operators. So that violates both causality, I guess that's a problem. But what it seems that you can do, order by order in the 1 over n expansion, you can find a tower of higher dimension multi-trace operators. And so what you imagine doing is saying that your bulk operator is not just a smearing kernel O1, but it has this more general form where it's a sum over different possible operators, smearing kernel appropriate to that operator times operators of increasingly high dimension. If you allow that as your ansatz for what a local field in the bulk should be, so you have this ansatz where you have this whole infinite tower of operators, then what you need to do is kind of fix the coefficients in front of each of those operators. It seems that bulk causality is enough to do that uniquely. And that seems to work order by order in the 1 over n expansion.
Why is that unique?
Yeah, why is it?
Why does it come to uniqueness here?
So you have a tower of operators of increasing dimension. Each individual operator will give you singularities. But the singularities are of different types. You get singularities where it's, the Lorentz distance, but raised to different powers that depend on the dimension of the operator. So you have this whole kind of infinite power series, and you need to choose it in order to cancel the singularity that was generated by the lowest order smearing function. So if, as far as we can tell, order by order in the 1 over n expansion, that's enough to fix things uniquely.
So is there a correlation between the choice of this, the determination of these coefficients, and what the actual bulk equation of motion may end up being, or is this
in
the 1 over n expansion? Or?
The two things seem to be equivalent.
Okay.
So when you solve the bulk equations of motion, you have this sort of expression, which is your first order correction is a Green's function times something that's quadratic in your lowest order field. So that's actually a double trace thing. In fact, it's a sort of a bilocal expression on the boundary. And you can think of that expanding that bilocal thing in derivatives. It's actually an infinite tower of double trace operators with more and more derivatives. Those are exactly the tower of double trace operators with more and more derivatives that you would add in this other approach. So as far as we can tell, for
singularities, they kind of cancel singularities that arise from singularities in the boundary correlation function. In that case, aren't give rise to singularities themselves, they're just motions.
That's right.
I don't understand your meaning, because it truly depends on the OPE of
boundary theory. Oh, it does, absolutely.
Given that you haven't said anything about that, it's surely not unique.
That's right. So the tower of operators that you need to add here certainly depend in detail on the OPE.
Which is that given OPE, given the force of theory of the boundary.
Yeah, that's what I'd like to imagine. We know everything about the CFT, the OPE, the correlators. Is there a way to lift that to an operator algebra in the bulk that obeys causality? And it seems that in the 1 over n expansion, it seems you can do that order by order.
But what is strange is that, surely there are other bulk fields that would be natural to introduce as well, given the nature of the opinions. But you say you don't need them, even though they're implicitly there in the simulation of the bulk fields. The cause of the simulation.
Right, so I need to be a little careful. This discussion about interactions has just been for scalar fields. And a very interesting question, I guess something that I was planning to maybe talk about a bit in the Blackboard part of this, is how does this work for gauge fields and the metric? So these results that I've shown you here are just for scalars.
But you've also been effectively assuming there's, so to speak, one scalar in the bulk, or you give yourself in the CFT a certain set of operators, and the larger limit goes to a single operator dimension delta, and the larger limit goes to a single operator dimension 2 delta, and so forth. That's the framework you mean when you say that there's a large N expansion that gives you a unique.
Yeah, that's what I should have done.
If it's really unique, can you turn it around and get the equations of motion?
The uniqueness.
Because you say afterwards it gives you the same, whatever. So could you turn it around and derive the equations of motion?
Sure.
Yeah.
Geometry and action gives you that 4-point function. I don't know the way to short circuit that.
That's right. I think the CFT OPE kind of does encode it in it. There is information about the bulk equations of motion.
Very interesting, but here your program doesn't involve any other bulk operators except the scale.
Yeah, that's right.
Although its correlation functions presumably had a one that you construct in something which is sort of local, not something which obviously has an OPE itself. The properties you like to demand of a look at, something like a quantum filtering in the, oh, it's more than just a kind of at the causality of this
one. You mean whether bulk interactions are local?
What are the singularities in the bulk? They might be causal, but are they
operator parties? So whether they have the canonical, Hadamard kind of form. It's true. You might wonder whether this condition that we're trying to impose is too weak or too strong. I don't really have a definitive answer there.
What comes up? What structure?
So the way it works, the 2-point function is kind of guaranteed to have the canonical short-distance singularity in the bulk because you've solved the appropriate weight equation. You do get from
2-point function. Yeah. 3-point function requires modifying that by adding another operator.
Does that change things? Yeah, that's a good question. I'm not sure. Maybe I'll say a little bit about how we got on these complex scalars.
One question on this, which is, interesting, this tower of operators you use to correct them. So, and you say you can, if I just give you a tower of operators with any, say, one over n corrections to their conformal dimensions, or are there any constraints that these, this works for any tower of operators of this kind? Or if I chose the 1 over n corrections to the conformal dimensions for this tower in a certain way, would you find that there is no bulk field?
I guess the idea is that in the 1 over n expansion, we start with some single trace operator, O1.
Yeah.
And then in the 1 over n expansion, I can build a tower of operators off that. I can build double trace operators by doing O1, and then a bunch of derivatives, maybe O1.
Okay.
So this is a double trace operator dimension starts at 2 delta, 2 delta plus 1, 2 delta plus 2. This is the tower of operators that I need. And in the 1 over n expansion, it's exactly the tower of operators that I have. So it all kind of works. It's a little hard to see how anything could go wrong in 1 over n perturbation theory.
At some point, you want to implement bulk unitarity relations on, well, you might turn these into something like S matrix elements. And, it's not clear that you get that correctly from the boundary theory.
Yeah, that's right. I mean, I think one would hope that unitarity of the boundary theory would somehow lead to bulk unitarity, but it's a good question. I don't know whether that's built in or whether that's an additional condition that needs to be imposed.
With regards to locality and maybe unitarity, it seems like a better thing to consider than correlation functions or the Mellon transformed correlation functions, because those are the things that reduce to S matrix elements. That's what reduces to the S matrix in the flat space limit. And so in flat space, we know how to define locality through an analytic. It's some analytic property of the S matrix when you complexify the lambda. So it might be the case that if one Mellon transforms CFT correlation functions, then at infinite n and all orders in 1 over n, it would be manifestly local in the same sense that, in the sense that the S matrix, that these Mellon transform amplitudes would have some nice fall-off property in the complex. In the complex
lambda. It's not clear that the Mellon transformation is sufficient to address this.
There's
another discussion.
Yeah, okay. I guess it's not clear, but it might be a different way of approaching some of these issues.
Yeah, absolutely. Let's see, well, maybe I'll say a little bit about how we got tied up in complex coordinates. So the reason we were kind of actually forced into doing this. At some point, we decided we wanted to study ADS3 in Rindler coordinates, and our goal there was to talk about BTZ black holes. So here are Rindler coordinates on ADS3. R is the kind of radial sort of holographic coordinate. T and X are coordinates on the boundary, but they just cover the they don't cover the full Poincaré boundary. They just cover the kind of Rindler wedge of it. So we wanted to, let's see. So I guess the idea, so you have sort of the Minkowski diamond on the boundary. You can look at the Rindler wedge of it. In the Rindler wedge, you know, correlators look thermal and all of that. But those Rindler coordinates on the boundary extend and into the bulk and cover some patch of the bulk, and you'd expect the CFT in that Rindler wedge to describe holographically that Rindler wedge in ADS. So that's what we wanted to do. So there's the coordinates, and there's an approach to constructing these smearing kernels, which is kind of conceptually straightforward, but in practice sort of a pain. Which is, you start with a field that satisfies the bulk equations of motion. It has some mode expansion. So there's an integral over omega and k, some amplitude for that mode. Along the boundary, it looks like a plane wave. And then there's some mode function, which tells you the profile in the bulk. And so that's an expansion of the bulk field on shell. You can ask how it behaves as you approach the boundary, as R goes to infinity. In that limit, your bulk field is supposed to go like R to the minus delta times some operator in the CFT. The mode expansion, these mode functions just fall off like R to the minus delta. You can cancel out the R's. That gives you an expression for the amplitudes, the A omega K's. They're basically just Fourier transforms of the operator on the boundary. So if you know how to represent those in terms of your boundary operator, you plug that back into your original mode expansion, and that does the job because you express your bulk field in terms of a bunch of integrals and kernels times some boundary operator. You can do that, and formally what you find is that the bulk field is an integral of some smearing kernel times the operator. The smearing kernel, formally, is the Fourier transform of the f omega k's. So that's just a few lines of algebra. So far, everything was well and good. If you could do that Fourier transform, we'd be done. But in fact, in Noether coordinates, something which kind of drove us crazy for longer than I care to remember, these f omega k's, they actually grow exponentially as k goes to plus or minus infinity. So that's actually a picture of one of them. So in the omega, along the omega axis, nothing really happens. But if you go to plus or minus infinity in the k direction, these mode functions just grow exponentially. And that means their Fourier transform just isn't defined. The program of trying to construct a smearing kernel using this bulk mode expansion kind of just crashes. You have to make sense of the Fourier transform of something that grows exponentially. But that does have a sensible interpretation. It's analytic continuation to complex values of the spatial coordinates.
Isn't this precisely why you should take the Mellin transform, not the Fourier transform? I mean, isn't the idea of Fourier transform is to the Poincaré group as Mellin transform is to the conformal group, right? So, Fourier transform is to flat space, as Mellin transform is to ADN space. Isn't that, if I were to take the SATs, isn't that?
Okay, well, you know, that's fine, but there's really kind of no freedom here.
Mellin transforms in the bulk.
Of the boundary.
But he's doing it in the bulk.
Yeah, this is my bulk mode expansion.
But you can also do it in the bulk. I mean, because it's instead of, yeah, you can also do it in the bulk. The Mellin transform is what you do if you want to, it's the Fourier transform on hyperbolic space.
Okay.
And you could talk about that, the conformal group either as the conformal symmetries of the boundary or the asymmetry group for the bulk.
You could, but I don't think it really buys you anything here, because, you know, in this coordinate system, you have translation invariance in T and X. You're going to get these plane waves. So there's really, there's no kind of ambiguity or flexibility here about what your mode expansion is. And so that's really what kind of forced us to this story about complex spatial coordinates. The story seems to be that if you want a smearing function that can represent a field in the Ringler patch, or I guess this is kind of a conjecture. If you ever want to make a smearing function that has support on the boundary that's the size of a Ringler patch or anything smaller, you're actually forced to go to the complex spatial coordinates.
But you agree that if you didn't want an actual function, quote, smearing function, which is a function of two positions, but you just wanted a recipe for taking the bulk operator and constructing it, or taking the boundary operator and constructing a bulk operator, you could do it without complexifying. You just do your integrals in a certain order. You first Fourier transform the boundary operator, and then you convolve the appropriate wave function in the bulk, and then you finally do the bulk Fourier transform. And if you have a good boundary operator, that procedure must converge.
That's right. In that story, I guess the question is, what's a good boundary operator? Since these mode functions grow exponentially with k, it means the Fourier transform of your boundary operator had better fall exponentially with k.
So I think it's true that the operator can be analytically continued. I think it's also, I think this also is an argument that if you have, for example, a smooth solution in the bulk, which is a priori not analytic, that in some sense its boundary data in these coordinates is analytic, at least a certain distance over the complex point.
Yeah, that's right.
It'd be interesting to know if there was a truly CFT argument which told you somehow the same thing. The correlation functions not just in the vacuum state, but in all states are analytic a certain distance of the complex plane in these coordinates.
That's right. That would be very interesting. We haven't tried to prove general theorems, but in practice, it seems to work that at least the correlation functions of these operators are analytic in the script that you need them to be in the complex plane.
So, with the Green's function instructions, is the problem from your point of view that it involves support that's outside of this Rinder diamond?
So yeah, that's right.
So it's not as holographic as. Sorry,
which Green's function?
If you start with full ADS3 and before you restrict this Rinder patch, you get an expression which is perfectly fine, but which involves integrals outside the.
Yes, that's right.
Diamond rings.
That's right.
Mm-hmm. And so you're saying there's a more local version of holography that one can get to with these compact coordinates.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah, I claim there's no Green's function that just has support in the kind of Rindler patch.
It may be a question of what since you want a Green's function. I mean, it seems to me that what you agree with me, I could take the boundary operator and integrate it. A Fourier transform with interpolation. That's sort of like saying that there exists a Green's function which is well defined as a kind of distribution that knows how to act on analytic boundary data.
And analytically shifts in some
direction. Right, so I'm just saying it's somewhat of a matter of semantics whether you want to say that you look at the complex plane or not.
I guess there are semantics about the words that go with this.
But the answer is yes.
But one way or another, you have to be able to do this this analytic continuation.
But you couldn't do the analytic continuation.
Suppose you had a boundary correlation function that was not sufficiently analytic.
Right. What would go wrong?
It appears to me that if you reconstructed the associated bulk object, it blows up at some point. You wouldn't have expected it.
Yeah.
What if you use this other group function?
It requires more data. Yeah. The one who Joe is referring to.
The same.
If you're just having boundary data in this Rindler patch, that's not enough data to run.
If you're not working closely with the patch.
So if you're supposing that there was some boundary correlation function, okay, which was defined over all the boundary of global ADS, and which in this patch, in these coordinates, were not sufficiently analytic, the other construction will give you a well-defined answer. Okay. The conjecture that I think Dan's making, that I think I believe, is that if you get a well-defined answer in the bulk, which is smooth as you expect, let's just do a one-point function which will be smooth, then the boundary data in these coordinates is analytic.
So both prescriptions would be identical.
I mean, the point is just that, as Dan said, if you take, look at the line up there where he writes phi in terms of A omega k and F, if you invert that transform in the bulk, you're doing the Fourier transform, and then because you're doing the Fourier transform, and because F is growing exponentially, you're multiplying the Fourier transform by a decaying exponential, which if you transform back gives you a function that's analytic a certain distance in the complex plane. Mm-hmm.
The bulk diffusers would be shocked, they get singularities, but what would the diffusers, what would the instructions be? There's no
better. Well, without, the first order guess is that when you get a certain distance into the bulk, the answer is just infinite at every bulk point beyond.
Very bad. Something
very bad.
Yeah.
But that's like some kind of Fickman-Dirac function in the boundary, effectively.
They're the coordinates.
You have a horizon in the bulk, and so things will be entering this horizon that the boundary patch doesn't know about. Mm-hmm. So somehow,
they usually go through and hit the boundary patch.
No. In his envisioning, not everything will hit this boundary patch. He's trying to reconstruct this region with a patch that's small enough that not everything hits it.
No, everything hits it.
Maybe, I'm envisioning this as a subregion of ADS3.
Yeah.
Yeah.
It's the intersection of a past light cone and a future light cone.
Can you draw this, maybe? Can you draw this?
No, it's like in the blur space. You can go.
Yes, there is a.
I'm like, I'm going to say it.
Okay.
I believe these coordinates you set in two null planes.
So that's the full punk right here. You're going to the full punk, right?
No.
Oh, that's our hand.
Good. You can see another null plane. And the regular wedge is one of those.
Right, so something can be traveling up through ADS and, right, and pass through your bulk region without ever touching the boundary.
You mean a particle or a GV?
Right.
Yeah, the wave packet has some dispersion, yeah, probably some small amount of propagation along the light current, so it leaves some imprint on the boundary.
Yeah, but clearly not enough. There's initial data on the past horizon that the boundary can't know about. Somehow this. There seems to be some. So in order to reconstruct this patch from the boundary, you need some to insert some information about what's entering through this horizon past in the future.
That's right. I mean, the kind of natural thing to do is in these coordinates to regard it as a thermal state that's equivalent to the global ADS vacuum.
But there could be, excitations that can, whether or not.
That's certainly.
And so let's field up the bulk field operators know about that, can measure that, but things you construct in the memory can't know about that.
Every bulk is a sum of these modes.
I mean, something
like this for the bulk.
That state information, whether you're in the bulk or the boundary, you just think of a space like slice inside a thermal wedge. There's some state information in the bulk, which is the stuff that came in through the horizons, but there's also some state information in the boundary field theory. I mean, he's calculating correlation functions on the boundary in some state, and that state carries information about the stuff that didn't come in from the boundary as explicit operator insertions.
Yeah, so the thermal state in the Rinder wedge is actually just empty global ADS. A state like this with some particle coming in through the past horizon and out through the future horizon would be some excitation about that. The CFT
should the boundary correlation functions care about the state of the CFT, so that information can get in that way.
And there could potentially be an issue about boundary conditions at sort of the bifurcation surface, but every solution somewhere here has stuff leading through the past and future horizons.
This example is more complicated than Poincaré coordinates. If you do it in Poincaré coordinates, that's clearly the answer.
Right.
Well, the information about what came in through the past Poincaré horizon is the state in the CFT.
This was kind of all I had in terms of slides.
That's predictive. No one had predicted.
I sort of had in mind doing some kind of open questions and issues and problems on the blackboard, but maybe we're sort of out of time. Do that some other time.
Another one of these working groups Thursday, right?
Which has,
can we ask some questions? One thing that's fascinating is it seems that this construction of the bulk, that O, D, 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 O on the top, that doesn't depend. You could be like a smaller TUF coupling, super heavy mills. You could have incredibly stringy geometry. And so microcausality is some notion that makes sense, or the solely out of gravity. I mean, it seems like you can pose this thing in a general way.
I guess there is kind of an important caveat, which is this construction of sort of microcausal operators in the bulk. As far as I can tell, it works order by order in 1/n for scalar fields.
Have you written down the 1/n squared yet? Have you written this out?
Yeah, I mean, what is it?
At some points, the 1/n squared are the first issues arise, and so.
Yeah, let's see. So we've done leading order 1/n Order 1 over n squared, we drew a diagram. It's actually, we haven't really calculated anything. And part of the reason is that, I think it's just sort of a technical issue, but that order 1 over n squared, you could have something where, so there's your CFT. You want some local operator in the bulk somewhere. In order 1 over n squared, from the bulk point of view, you could have diagrams like that. So you meet bulk loops. These things are divergent. Presumably, there are anomalous dimensions in order 1 over n squared in CFT. So, you know, the smearing kernel, depending on the dimensions, you sort of have to renormalize that. So I think it's just kind of a purely technical question of calculating this, regularizing it.
The loops are probably right there if you can find some way to write to.
That's what I would expect.
Do you think there's some notion of local geometry in this causality, in this highly stringy?
Which is he hasn't included the stress tensor.
You're restricting yourself to scalar.
The scalar, that's about.
Even if you're restricting yourself to scalars, at some point, if you did the real scalar, the real string,
it has an OPE with the stress tensor.
You don't get just derivatives, you get covariance derivatives.
So you put the stress tensor, that's what you're calling it. That's what the facts actually
are.
Okay. Ask you the question.
So approve them.
Something should go wrong. I mean, I'll show my cards.
Why are you doing these bilocals and not spherical?
I think the question of whether something could go wrong with this construction. This really is, I think, kind of an open question, something that. As far as I can tell, sort of 1 over n corrections, for standard fields, it seems to work. Things seem to work. It seems that you could implement bulk causality. In the 1 over n expansion, you don't have much of a choice. When you consider 1 over n corrections, it's not just scalar operators that are going to show up. You're also going to get the stress tensor. And you're inevitably going to have to include gravity. And for scalars, it seems that causality is OK. Gravity.
Scalars means you have one operator plus derivative of the summit?
Yeah.
That's
a double trace.
A double trace with a bunch of derivatives.
And you don't need the single trace with covariant derivatives?
Let's see. I don't.
What is N? Are you restricting something vector model?
The actual example we did was just a phi cube theory, and we took phi the coupling in the bulk to be 1 over one
phi matrix.
It's like a matrix, but
phi cube with an estimate.
So what we considered was a bulk phi cube theory, and the phi cube. Can we identify the bulk coupling with 1 over n?
The phi is traced with a matrix.
Use
a 1 over n. nominally on that?
So phi is a scalar in the bulk. On the boundary, it would be an operator that's trace of a matrix. So phi itself would be dual to a single trace operator, but things like what I wrote up here would be a double trace operator.
But the same thing would work if phi were a scalar product of vectors. Where do you use the difference between vector and
Yeah, that's a good question. The large N counting that we did, we kind of implicitly had in mind a large N matrix model for CFT. But yeah, it's a good question. If you did the same counting for a large N vector model, the results
are well come out. Could you just change the number to 1 over square root of n?
Yeah, that's the minimal.
That's all the matching.
That's the minimal guess. I think kind of a more interesting question in a way is what happens when you do 1 over n corrections with gravity? And then I think I have to kind of put a question mark by causality. Because I think there are three different stories I could give you here. And I go back and forth on which one I believe. So here's one story of what will happen when you try to include gravity and incorporate microcausality. So I guess this is kind of the optimist scenario. And the optimist, I used to be an optimist, but
you came here.
The optimist would say that you don't really expect a local bulk theory, because it is, quantum gravity in the bulk. So you expect locality to break down. But locality violations, where should they come from? They should come from things like holographic entropy bounds. Bounds from thinking about black holes in the bulk. And these things, holographic entropy bounds, they're invisible in the 1 over n expansion. Well, it's the same thing, they're invisible if you just do perturbation theory in the bulk. So the optimist would tell you that to all orders in perturbation theory, to all orders in 1 over n, there should be no obstacle to implementing bulk locality and causality.
The holographic
think you have
leading order in
and that's right, but the holographic entropy bounds are bounds that are of order n squared. They're kind of semi-classical. They're associated with semi-classical black holes, not things that you'd see in perturbation theory around ABS. I guess another story that I can tell you is kind of a pessimistic story. So this is something that we kind of noticed when we were doing that we noticed in this last paper. What we noticed is that if you work at linearized order, so just linearized gravity around an ABS background, I think at some point I had the commutation relations for the metric. And those look very non-local. So like in ABS 3, when you write down the commutation relations in the bulk for the metric, it actually obeys a Virasoro algebra. But it's completely non-local in the x plus and z directions. So it's hard to understand any notion of locality if you look at the metric. But one thing that we noticed was that instead of the metric, if you look at the vowel tensor in the bulk, and well, we didn't actually do the commutator of two vowel tensors. We did a vowel tensor in the bulk and the stress tensor on the boundary. This is three dimensions. This is any dimension. It turns out these things actually obey causality.
It's a leading order, whatever.
Yes.
Linearized gravity.
And this seems to be some fact which I guess has been known and observed. In linearized gravity, the vowel tensor is actually gauge invariant. It's gauge invariant to linearized order around an ABS background. And so then we got hopeful here. At linearized order, the vowel tensor obeys some notion of bulk causality. Maybe we could take this property and use it as a guiding principle to work to next order in 1 over n. Got to talking to Don, and he has some very good arguments that this is actually not possible, that this will actually fail at the first non-trivial order in the 1 over n expansion. I'm not really sure what to make of that, because somehow that seems like too dramatic a breakdown of bulk locality. I don't expect an exactly local theory in the bulk, but the idea that bulk locality would somehow fail.
So the breakdown in the 3D case is has to do with the choice of gauge, radio gauge.
Yeah. Oh, that's hardly gauge to tell.
So it's just radio gauge.
It's true, right? And,
sorry?
It's not local in every physical gauge.
Is that right?
Yeah. Oh, yeah. I believe so.
Axial like gauge.
And cool. Right. Every age in which there are not extra degrees of freedom. Every age in which you don't put extra degrees of freedom in the problem space.
Anything with numbers that you
apply. So that's why typically look for locality gauges, which have some physical degrees of freedom and then are local, and then we go to everything under it. And then try to connect them by gauges or by word entities. Usually does it, but. Is your argument also that it fails in order 1 over n connected to a gauge choice?
In any physical gauge. Any physical gauge. But indeed, if you work in a covariant gauge, there may be a way to do something.
No, but you know, from any physical, it happens in special gravity, any gauge.
Well, it's special for gravity. For any gauge theory, for normal gauge theory, you can work with approximately local operators like Wilson loops that are truly gauge invariant.
There are almost all new imaginary advantages. Local gauge invariant observables.
But indeed, if you're talking about just the curvature tensor and not a VOA Mills theory, it has the same issue.
Right, but it's roughly the same problem. You could prove locality in one gauge, prove inequality in another gauge.
Sure. Maybe you can do something useful constructing a bulk to boundary map in some covariant gauge.
Yeah.
But that's a
harder problem.
It's a harder problem because we usually say that ABS CFT is something that makes sense mapping observables to observables. Mm-hmm. So.
Yeah, but you know, the question is how theory, by the way, has had lots of. You know, boundary theory you assume is given to you, but actually at a microscopic level one constructs it in terms of an observable.
like coded in the freedom, you know, see in the book. So on both sides, you anybody have this problem. I don't see the reason not to, if you're playing this game.
What are the ghosts? What are the unphysical polarizations? They have no kind of natural role in the CFT.
But you might say the same thing about the boundary theory. What are the quarks and what are the colors?
In the boundary theory, we know how to construct gauge invariant observables in principle, right? But in the bulk theory, F squared, trace F squared, Wilson loops. In the bulk theory, we don't really know quite what the target is for a local or an approximately local observer.
And then, let's see, so this is the optimist, the pessimist, and maybe kind of a third possibility, which, I'll put Joe here, though.
Probably do the adjective.
We'll find out. And this is kind of a possibility which Joe and collaborators have looked at these sorts of issues. Under what conditions do you hope to have some sort of local description of physics in ADS? And he had some kind of interesting conclusions that if you want to have some sort of at least approximate notion of bulk locality, that it seems that corresponds to a CFT with a large gap in the spectrum of operator dimensions. I really kind of don't have anything definite to say here, but maybe if you try to do 1 over n corrections with gravity, maybe you'll see this condition kind of coming in and playing a role. Maybe there'll be the idea that the CFT has a few low dimension operators and then a large gap to, you could think of them as stringy states. And the size of the gap would somehow set the scale for the failure of locality in the bulk. That's kind of a third possibility that that maybe could be realized. I don't have anything definite to say here. As I say, I've kind of gone back and forth on in terms of which one I kind of believe or think is plausible. But one of the things that I like about this program is that you have some machinery, you can actually go ahead and calculate 1 over n corrections and kind of see which one of these scenarios plays out, or maybe none of the above.